This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Mishay Show.
It's officially NFL draft season.
You're listening to the Ryan Russillo Podcast. I have some other announcements coming up, but really
when's
happy.
When's the last time we worked together?
The Bill Simmons Podcast.
All right, we're bringing in Todd Mishay. You have the Mishay Report, an excellent newsletter that is really becoming more and more exciting.
Our friend from The Ringer, the Mishay Show. Get it wherever you get your podcast, certainly on the Spotify platform. Ladies and gentlemen, Todd Mishay.
Well, the beauty is we get to say whatever we want now. There's nothing holding us back. There's no political draw. There's no corporate draw. I'm just saying. Like, so if you want the real, come hang with us.
The Chicago Bears are on the clock.
Mach 3.0 round one and plus two additional picks because I get two trades, teams trading it. Okay. The pick that everyone is like, whoa, the Bears at 10.
The Chicago Bears select.
I love it. We're going out to LA for the week. And we're not going to be in Green Bay. We're not going to have huge crowds. And we're not going to have all these cameras and you know, flyovers and all, and thousands of fans and all that stuff. But we're kind of the not f***ing around crew.
I need to get them in a room. This is the not f***ing around crew.
Spiegel and Holmes, afternoons on The Score.
Yeah, why not? Let's do it up big. Todd Mishay now joining us here on the Spiegel and Holmes show on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circa app today. Todd, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. I'd love to know, like, you've been doing this, what, 25 years now where you've been studying the draft? How would you characterize how players themselves and their attitudes towards the draft have changed?
First of all, how about that intro? You guys are the not messing around crew. I like it.
That's what we do. That's what we do. It's our guy, Chris Tannehill, right there.
Chris, I'm impressed, man. I sound like a raging lunatic, so I'll try to keep it under wraps here. That's a good question, and I do think things are changing. And I think, you know, like I don't want to give off this impression. I think the guard has changed in the NFL. I don't think it's like the old crusty NFL executive and can't relate to the player. Like, I've seen that guard get kind of pushed out, and the people who are making decisions now are well in tune with kind of what the player has gone through in their lives and what they're used to. And through the NIL and through the transfer portal, there's been player empowerment, and rightfully so. I think there could potentially be a happy medium or some kind of, you know, governing body, and we kind of get a cap on all of this stuff. But at the end of the day, you've got to be able to relate to the player. If Nick Saban can adjust his coaching style to adjust to the current player, then who, you know, everybody else should be able to. I do think it's created some challenge in the scouting in terms of, like, a lot of guys aren't running not working out at the combine. A lot of guys just aren't running a 40. Go ahead. Like, you get the miles per hour on the zebra technology or what,
the catapult
technology. So, and teams are frustrated by that because the fastest guys don't always run the fastest on that. And maybe they didn't run a 40. And how do you tell the offensive lineman? And I think some drills and things that happen in pro day workouts will change. But at the end of the day, like, there's a lot of tape out there. And the other part, too, that I think people are realizing, I've never before in my life, when I go through and write up the 400 evaluations, I've never in 25 years written up so many times six-year player, five-year starter, or, you know, six-year player, three-and-a-half-year starter. It used to be like you redshirt as a freshman or you don't. You wind up with 2 years of starting experience, 25, 27 starts. If you got in the 30s, that was good. Occasionally, you'd see someone with 42. I'm writing up guys constantly with 48, 53, 61, 65 starts or games played. So there's a lot more tape in general to go off of. And so you got to trust your eye, and you've got to hire people who are capable of evaluating talent. And I think NFL teams feel pretty comfortable with what they have.
That voice belongs to Todd McShay. Very cool to be talking to him on the Spiegel and Holmes show here on The Score. All right, since you like the intro, let's follow up on something that was in there. You hinted at the fact that now you don't have to talk about things the way certain corporate overlords would prefer you to talk about them. So what does that mean? What are we talking about? What did you feel? What did you feel pushed to do?
Yeah. Sir? I prefaced that with, I had been texting with someone, and it doesn't matter who, I would never reveal. And this is an indictment, but I just find it interesting when you are able to communicate with some people who are, and I want to make this perfectly clear. No one ever once told me in my previous job what to say, not to say, maybe steer at this. Like a couple times I was told, like, you know, when I told Kuiper he was asinine, I was like, you know, they're like, can you dial it back a little bit? Like, let's not, the name calling. But that was it. Like, no one ever, you're free to say whatever you want. But there's also, like, you know, people understand that there's, you got to be careful with what you say in certain situations, and maybe you want interviews, and maybe you want access, and maybe, you know, like, so I don't have to worry about that anymore. That was my only point that I was making. And this time of year is a lot of fun talking to a lot of friends in the league and acquaintances and getting good information. And there's a certain level of freedom, and it's not that I was ever told I can't or handcuffs were put on. Just simply the time restraints that you had and commercial breaks and 90 seconds and clips. And now I can just talk, and I don't have to worry about, well, you know, we got to be careful, and just no one ever saying it, but there's being an understanding of, hey, you know, we've got to make sure that we don't, you know, cut off access and all that. I feel certain freedom with this new gig with The Ringer and Spotify, working on the McShay show, a new freedom that I've kind of never felt that I had, and it's been a lot of fun to do.
Where do you fall on desperation versus evaluation at the quarterback position? And here's what I mean, Todd. Where I remember when Jackson Dart was coming out of high school, and I'm like, yo, that guy's probably an NFL quarterback. He tracks, and then his career has kind of had fits and starts. Shedeur Sanders is another one who I think is kind of interesting, and it's been weird to see his name be all the way up at number two and also in the second round. When you're trying to evaluate where guys you think are going to be drafted, how much of what NFL front offices and their desperation to find a quarterback, how much of that goes into the evaluation?
We could do a whole hour show on that. I'll say this. There's no more important position, as we all know, probably in sports, certainly in football. And because of the salary cap and because of since the collective bargaining agreement and how, quote unquote, cheap these rookie players are compared to what you have to pay them on a second contract and beyond, it's worth taking hacks. It used to be where you didn't want to draft a quarterback in the top five if you weren't absolutely certain about it, because it could set your organization back 7-10 years, right? Now that's not the case. We've seen it. You can take a hack, completely swing and miss, get back up off the mat 2 years later and draft another guy. And Arizona did it with Kyler Murray, right? So that, you have to keep that in mind with all of this. I rank the players where I rank the players based off the grade and the tape, and I'll adjust it slightly based off of medical concerns and character issues and all of that. And every team does the same process. But quarterbacks, you have to look at it as its own entity. We need one. Where are we going to get one? And it's really expensive to go get a veteran. And veterans almost never, the good ones almost never leave where they are. Right. And so it becomes a game of, okay, we're here. We got to draft one. But then you also got to balance that, right? You get, like, if you're Cleveland at two and the Giants at three, you might like Shedeur, but I'm staring at Travis Hunter. And this guy's legitimately got a chance to do something no one has ever done in the NFL before. Yeah, Deion played a lot on was primarily a defensive player, a lot on the return game, huge impact there, a little bit on offense. Had like 60-something career catches, whatever the number is. Charles Woodson, we always talk about Charles Woodson, Champ Bailey, two-way threats. You know, they were dynamic. They had fewer than like 7 catches combined in their career. So Travis Hunter's got a chance to do something so special and different that no one's ever been able to impact both sides of the ball the way he could potentially impact it. And then you get Abdul Carter, the second most important position, an elite player, a blue chip, whatever you call it. So you've got to do a cost analysis there, right? Like, yeah, I do like Shador, or I do really like Jackson Dart, but I've got to take one of these two elite players. And then I think that's why you're seeing, more so than I can remember, like, we're 14 days from the draft right now, fellas. And I'm seeing reports every day pop up. Jalen Milroe's here. Jackson Dart's there. Tyler Shuck's here. Shador Sanders is still flying around. He was at Pittsburgh Airport yesterday, right? So I think teams have come to the realization now that you've got all these meetings, the postseason, scouts back 15 months, and then the meetings. And now you've kind of finalized and you're putting together, you're putting the final touches on your board. But you know if it's yes or no on a guy like Shador at number 2 or 3, and the answer is no. And so now there's this like, all right, so where are we going to get it? Can we get one at 33 if you're Cleveland, or 34 of the Giants, or we're going to have to move up? And let's get one last opportunity to talk to, study how they study, see them throw. Let's go through this process quickly at the end so it's fresh in our minds and we get the final sense of what we want to do, because then we got to make a tough decision. If you're Cleveland, you draft Travis Hunter at 2 and you want Shador, and I think Shador is going to be sitting there at number 10 on the first night of the draft. How high do we go up to get him? Because if we go up to like 10, 11, 12, it might cost us a first next year. We get down to like 14, 15, 16, that range, ahead of Pittsburgh at 21 that needs a quarterback. Maybe it's only a 2 next year, or maybe it's a 3 this year, a 4 this year, and only a 3 next year. So that's what we get 2 weeks to figure it all out, and it's fascinating. But we're seeing a lot of quarterbacks fly around late, aren't we? And I think a lot of it has to do with teams realizing, all right, we're going to have to get that second market. And I think Jackson Dart, if there's a quarterback drafted at 9, I think it's going to be Jackson Dart. So you could be looking at Shador on the board at 10.
Todd, we know what the Lions did when they took Jahmyr Gibbs, and we have seen what the league just got out of Saquon Barkley and Derrick Henry.
Yes, sir.
But is Ashton Jeanty special enough? Is the difference between him and, say, Quinshon Judkins and Travion Henderson, is the difference big enough to merit taking him in the top 10 if you are the Bears?
It is. And I want to be perfectly clear, I think Omarion Hampton's the second best back in this class out of North Carolina. I think he's going to be a star. I think Travion Henderson, if utilized in the role he was utilized in at Ohio State, similar to that role you were just, you know, alluding to with Jahmyr Gibbs in Detroit, is going to be a star. I think Judkins can be a star. I think Caleb Johnson could be a really good back out of Iowa. I think Camp Scataboo, if he can hold up physically from that pounding style, has got a chance to be a really good back, at least in his rookie contract. I think there's 10 other guys that can be in a rotation that can be impact players, maybe 15. This is the deepest, most talented running back class I've ever evaluated in 25 years, and it's, I don't want to say it's not close, but it's pretty clear to me. But he's that special, man. He is that special. The quickness, the lateral agility, the vision, the power, the breaking tackles, the missed tackles forced. He reminds me of Alvin Kamara then in the passing game. Give him a little screen and pick up 7 to 12. I mean, he's different than all of them. I haven't talked to an NFL team that doesn't have him in that top 5, and just about everyone I've talked to, it's top 3 or 4. I'm talking with Abdul Carter, Travis Hunter, and then maybe it's Tyler Warren or Mason Graham, but he's in that conversation with those 5 guys that are considered the blue chip players in this class.
Do you believe that the Bears' interest in Jeanty is real, and could you see them getting him, even moving up if they had to?
I don't see why you move up. I don't, because there is Omarion Hampton and there are all those other backs that I mentioned. And while you love to have him and you think he's going to be absolutely special, I think with Ben Johnson and what he just had, if you have 2 backs, one of, and they complement one another, it can be just as dynamic as having one back that's going to do all that for you. And so to me, Chicago's in kind of this weird spot, right? They're hoping for quarterbacks to go. I think potentially two could go before they pick at 10. And then there's about six blue chip players. I named five of them. I would throw Jalen Walker in there. I think Campbell's going to go at four, the offensive tackle. Will Campbell from LSU to go to the Patriots at four would be my guess right now. And so you get down to 10, and it's like, who's left? I just had this mock draft that came out today, mock 3.0. If Tyler Warren's there, you run it in. And I know you've got Cole Kmet, but you talk about trying to support your franchise quarterback. And I just think about have the two tight end sets. You get another run. They pick at 39 and 41. You can get a running back there. Maybe it's Judkins there. Maybe if you get lucky and Travion Henderson's there at 39, although I don't know that he will be. And you take advantage of having three picks in the top 41. I wouldn't give one of those up to go up a few spots just to get, not just to get Jinty, who's worth the pick wherever he goes, as long as it's pick four or beyond. I wouldn't trade up, though, to go get him because I think there are enough backs to do it. It's not a premium position, and there's a lot of value in having three picks in those top 41 because if two of them turn out to be great and one turns out to be just okay, that's a phenomenal draft.
What's the tape say about Tyler Warren?
So it's interesting. He's more like in the Gronk area than he is like, you know, everyone does Gronk or Kelsey. You know, is he what? He's still improving as a blocker. You see, like the effort will be there. He'll continue to get better. He just wasn't used as much as for a guy who's like 6'5" and change, and you know, right around 260 pounds. He wasn't used as a blocker as much because the entire offense ran through him. And what they did, Kolenicki, the offensive coordinator for Penn State, I thought it was brilliant how he used him. I just imagine Ben Johnson, what he would cook up in the lab for this guy, though. I mean, you saw against USC snapping the ball, going down, catching a touchdown pass. They use him at H-back, basically almost a tailback at times. They use him in the wing. They spread him out wide. You can hand him the ball. He can occasionally throw the ball, like former high school quarterback. He's just such a unique talent. But I think what, to me, he doesn't separate as well with his feet and agility as Colston Loveland does, or certainly Brock Bowers did a year ago coming out. But the late separation he gains with his size, his instincts and getting open as a receiver. And I think kind of his special trait is he's like a big bruising fullback when he gets the ball. And I just like flashes back to Gronk just bulldozing guys and ripping through tackles. That's kind of what you see on tape, and I think that's the role he's going to play in the NFL. And you got a young quarterback who needs kind of some security around him. I think that he would be an awesome chess piece for Ben Johnson.
So, look, we're always trying to figure out what we need to know about the new Bears head coach, and you mentioned Ben Johnson. What have people told you about him and his style that you can share?
I think there's this impression that he's like this, and I just said cook up in the lab, and there's obviously an element to him that makes him special as one of like the elite play callers and play designers in the NFL. But what I've heard and from very reliable sources, really good in the building. Like he's not, you know, you think, I don't know, Mike Martz or some other, like this guy is relatable. He cares. He's been waiting a long time for this, and this was not made lightly. I think that's pretty public at this point. Like he was waiting. This was on the very short list and by all accounts at the top of the list. And so he's been preparing for this moment for a while, and he studied, you know, leadership and under the head coaching guidance of Dan Campbell, who's like, you would think is kind of the opposite of him. And in a lot of ways they are, but I think what he learned from Dan is how important the team is, how important everyone having the same kind of mission and goal and the personality of this team. And I think as time goes on, you'll see that he's a lot more than just an offensive play caller and this like mad scientist guy.
All right, last thing, Todd. If we woke up the day after round one and the Bears took an edge rusher, either at 10 or if they trade down a few spots, somewhere between 10 and 17, something like that, who would we feel best about? Which edge rusher in that range would we feel best about?
I don't think you'd be disappointed. At 10, it's like, okay, well, what else was available? But at the end of the day, you're trying to get impact football players at key positions, premium positions. Excuse me. I think Jalen Walker is the second best edge coming out of Georgia. Some people can say, well, he's a tweener off the ball. I just think he's so damn explosive, man. But I don't think he's going to get there. So if we're talking in reality, to me, Mike Green is just, he's like, when you watch him, it's like the violent street fighter, plays with power and quickness, powerful upper body. I think he has like a 401 level for a college prospect, a 401 level of pass rush array, like the array of moves that he has. I think that he would be a great fit in Chicago. I lean towards Texas A&M pass rusher, Shamar Stewart. Like, I believe in his potential. I think the instincts and awareness are still kind of developing, but I also didn't like the way they used him at Texas A&M. But we talk about, you know, 6'5", 267 pounds, running a 4.58. His explosiveness, the way he bends and moves. Like, I know Trayvon Walker was the number one overall pick and he was more explosive traits, if you will. I think this guy's more flexible. I think that could be a possibility if you move back a little bit. But Mykel Williams has got a lot of potential. James Pierce is probably the second best pure pass rusher, but has some of the character stuff. But there's six pass rushers that are going to come off the board, I believe, in the first round. So if you can get a deal to move back and get additional picks and get one of those six, that would be a huge win. But who's going to move up? And maybe Shador getting past 9 would help in that cause.
Check Todd out at The Ringer. He's doing incredible stuff with the Todd McShay Show. Thanks for the time. We really appreciate this, man. And Todd, I'm happy that you found what you were looking for and joy and being back in this game the way that you always have been.
I appreciate that, man. I really have, and I appreciate you saying that because it's true. And let's have some fun. 14 days out, right?
Yep. See, you're sounding better than ever. You can call us asinine anytime.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
That's Todd McShay. Show him some love. Follow what he's doing over at The Ringer and become smarter about football evaluation. Speaking of football and the Bears and what they might do at the draft and the fact that there was OTAs this week, Jason Leisure is going to join us next here on The Score.
Kyra, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, fellas. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
We're holding up. I'm curious. Yesterday, listen, the weather's been awful, and you guys have been winning series, and that's really all anyone is after. But I don't know if it was the combination of Shota just not being Shota, having a rough go, which, again, probably weather-related. But I think that Justin Steele news kind of took everyone for a little bit of by surprise. Was this a pre-existing thing, or did he just come out of that start with a sore elbow?
Kind of both. You know, obviously, it's the same injury as last year, something that's been nagging him. So, that happens with players, you know, where there's something that, you know, kind of pops up here and there, you know, throughout their careers. And Justin's no exception there, and, you know, this one popped up. It's not something that had been hurting him in spring training. You know, he'd been in a really good place, and, you know, we're hopeful that we caught it early and that we'll be able to get him back here soon, and, you know, that's why we're taking a conservative route here.
What is the level of concern, and is Jordan Wicks part of the plan to perhaps replace him for a start here or there?
Yeah, I mean, there's always concern when you're dealing with injuries with any player, especially somebody as talented as Justin, but, you know, right now all we got to do is figure out exactly what's going on in there and then, you know, adjust as necessary. But, you know, this is something that almost every team is dealing with. And, you know, we certainly, you know, built up our starting pitching depth to be able to withstand things like this. And you got guys like Wicks, Colin Ray, obviously Javi Assad is going to be coming off the IL here. You know, not imminently, but, you know, soon, hopefully this month. And, you know, then you got other guys in the minor leagues, your Cade Hortons of the world. And then,
right.
you know, there's somebody that no one's thinking about that's going to be helping us out over the course of this year. So I think the answer is all of those guys are going to be part of the answer. And, you know, with winning teams that go long into the season and into the off season, they have to have a lot of answers.
Obviously, an off day today. You guys traveling to California, and we know that that Justin wasn't scheduled to pitch until Sunday. Is there any chance that J-Mo could go? Because I think you're off next Thursday too. Do you not want to load up anybody early, or is there an opportunity to maybe take advantage of a couple of off days and try to get by without kind of starting someone unexpected?
Yeah, you certainly don't want to throw guys off of their routines if that's not something that you have to do. You know, I think an interesting byproduct of the Japan series, if you look at our early schedule, there's a lot of off days, especially on Thursdays. It almost looks like a minor league schedule or the new minor league schedule, which is nice. You know, that allows us to have some flexibility in how we go about maneuvering our pitching and our roster. And, you know, from that perspective, you know, we're glad that the schedule laid out this way, and we'll use that to our advantage as best as we can.
So let's talk about Matt Shaw for a moment, because I think there's a lot of focus on and hope that he is going to be the guy that is the everyday third baseman this season. He's not great at the plate so far, hitting just 170, but he is getting on base because he's walked 10 times. How do you balance one against the other, Carter? And what are reasonable expectations for Matt Shaw? And also, how much patience is the front office and maybe Craig Council going to have?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a broad scope, we're trying to win baseball games, and so we're going to try to make decisions to put our best team out there. But what Matt's done really well is he's played great defense, and I think there's a lot of encouraging signs at the plate. And I think you mentioned the plate discipline. That's certainly been good, his ability to get on base. You know, and I think he's taking better swings, you know, over the last week. And you know, he's seen some really good arms and some really not great hitter-friendly weather. And, hopefully – over the course of, you know, the next weeks and months, that he'll be able to slow things down a little bit and get back to his natural talent. I expect that'll happen. But I think you look at all the young players around the league and just the adjustment it is to go up to the big league so quickly, it's really, really difficult. And I think the fact that we're seeing some progress here is encouraging, and we'll continue to play that out.
You know, it isn't. You're right about the weather and everything going on early in the season, but man, you guys have been killing the ball. It's been kind of fun to see you. I think it's 8 of the last 10 games or 9 7-run games, something crazy like that. You've been really able to put up some runs. You just needed the 7 yesterday, and everything would have been fine. But what's it like seeing that and knowing? I mean, you know, we talked about it during spring training, how – you know, everybody wants everyone to be hitting, and it doesn't matter till the season starts. Well, everybody's doing a pretty good job of hitting.
Yeah, it's been really encouraging early, you know, and I think we've all realized that, you know, sometimes these things can be feast or famine, and so really the only thing you can do is focus on the next game and making sure you try to just continue to have your best approach for the next game. And I think that's what guys have been doing, you know, and then when we've had a tough game, we've come back and played well the next one. And I think that's just all you really can focus on in just long of a marathon of a season like this is. But yeah, to your point, it's been really encouraging. The ability to take walks, the ability to hit with runners in scoring position, the ability to drive the ball, it's all been going really well. And that means a lot of runs, and that typically leads to a lot of wins.
This is Mullane Haw. We're talking with Cubs general manager Carter Hawkins, who is appearing on behalf of Paws Chicago, whose mission is to build no-kill communities, to end overpopulation of homeless animals, and to transform animal welfare. One of those guys hitting the cover off the ball is Kyle Tucker. And certainly, Carter, you know how it goes when you have a guy entering the final year of his contract. The conversation has already begun about what he is worth and can he stay forever? Because that's what we want him to stay forever. What is the Cubs' policy? What is the approach with Kyle Tucker? Are you open for contract negotiations during the season? Is that something that's up to the player? Or what is your stance when we talk about the contract future for Kyle Tucker?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll repeat a lot of the stuff Jed said. You know, we'll keep those conversations internal, whether they're happening or whether they're not happening. But I'll also repeat what Jed said, and that, you know, he's a player you want to build around, and he's absolutely an elite hitter in this league and played a great defense as well. And he's carried our lineup, you know, along with our catchers over the last couple of weeks. And, you know, we'll expect to see that continue through the season. And, you know, just thrilled that we have him on this club.
Crazy lot of money floating around. And we just saw another contract extension in Toronto and another big deal. And, you know, you keep wondering, like, how big are these contracts getting? Do you have to move quicker? Because if you, the more you wait, the bigger the con. Like, how do you judge that? How do you balance the kind of price of playing poker going up so exorbitantly?
Yeah, I mean, generally, you know, you're trying to judge markets. You're trying to understand, you know, are there certain positions, certain players that are overvalued or undervalued, and, you know, allocate your dollars appropriately, you know, within those contexts. But, you know, it's hard to judge markets. You know, the guys that are doing it on Wall Street, you know, are having a really hard time right now, and it's not too much easier over here in baseball either. So, yeah, I mean, those are conversations that we're constantly having, you know, during the off season, during the season, you know, trying to understand where there might be some inefficiencies. And, you know, we're just trying to make sure that, you know, when we're spending money, that money is going towards wins, and that money is going towards wins in an efficient fashion. And there's a lot underneath that sentence, but that's really the goal.
So you have access to all the information, all the camera angles, all the stuff. You also have access to the players and what they're thinking and how they're feeling and what they might be dealing with that we're not aware of. Help us understand Ryan Pressly and the start that he's off to, because the numbers say that, you know what, it's acceptable, it's fine, and he's going to get better. There have been some shaky moments. There's no doubt about it. You can't get around it. He's here to close games. He's here to pitch the ninth inning. How would you describe the start he's off to, and is there anything that you see that can be or will be corrected?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're talking about guys that are throwing the ninth, obviously there's a magnifying glass on that. And so they get talked about more, which, you know, is understandable, and that kind of comes with the territory with that. You know, I think the stuff has actually been pretty good relative to where he's been over time. And that part's encouraging to know that, hey, look, it's still in there. I think really for him, it's, you know, he's going to have some contact. He's going to have some balls put on the ground, and, you know, some of those balls are going to get through. I think for him, it's about ability to command and ability to get ahead, ability not to walk a guy and then have a hit on top of that is when really traffic starts happening. And that's really where it gets, you know, a little bit tight in the ninth inning, of course. So, you know, we're encouraged that the stuff is still there. You know, we're going to continue to try to work on helping to have him be able to land that stuff in an effective way as possible, and, you know, encouraged about his ability to help us out at the back end of games, and, you know that there's a lot of other guys that are supporting him as well. You know, I thought Porter Hodge was really, really good the other night, despite a couple of hits that just happened to be hitting to the corners, and same thing with Julian Merriweather. You're seeing Brad Keller, you know, start to establish himself as someone that potentially could help us out at the end of the games, and from that perspective, we'll just continue to try to put our best guys out there so that we can win as many games as we can.
Carter, we had a fun conversation with Tommy Hotovy recently where we were asking him his thoughts on the torpedo bats. You know, kind of everybody, it just became this like rage and bait. Oh, look at the end with the torpedo bat. And he kind of laughed and said that with all the different pitches that are, you know, we're changing the names of some pitches we're familiar with, but there seems like every time you turn around, the pitching people are really coming up with something crazy and cool, and they're moving the ball and everything else. And he kind of joked that it's high time the hitters kind of responded. And what's your take on that torpedo bat stuff?
Yeah, I mean, so it's something that we've been working on for a long time, you know, maybe 2 years, and really hadn't been talking about it with anyone, obviously,
right?
Because we wanted to try to keep it to ourselves. And I think there was some kind of convergent evolution happening where some other teams were coming to some of the same conclusions. The funny part on the name piece, and I was laughing about this with our guys, is we had named ours a reverse taper bat, which, like, in retrospect, is just not the best marketing play.
Reverse taper? Did you say reverse taper
That's
bat?
What he said. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly.
Rolls right off the tongue. The
reverse taper. And then somebody started talking about torpedoes. I'm like, oh, man, yeah, we should have gone with torpedo. the fact that we didn't hit 5 home runs in our, you know, in our first game, I think, and no one noticed it, and the fact that we called it reverse taper probably was why a lot of those articles were written about us. But, you know, look, like, this is such a fun game where you're always trying to find, you know, just 1% advantages, and, you know, I think these reverse taper bats or torpedo bats or bowling pin bats or whatever you want to call it is an opportunity to find some of that advantage. And, you know, we have some really, really smart people in our organization that work on things like that all the time. And, you know, just glad to see that, you know, yeah, the hitting side is finally punching back a little bit here in terms of innovation. And, you know, I expect that will continue to happen.
Well, I think one guy who's benefiting from whatever you want to call it, but Dansby Swanson has 4 home runs already and looks like he's got more power at the plate, Carter. And I just wonder, he also looks as fluid as ever in the field. The offseason core surgery, or however you want to describe that, how much difference did that make in allowing him to maybe be the player earlier this season than we have seen before? Because you look at him and he looks more dangerous to the plate. And I just wonder what effect that offseason surgery had.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for Dansby, and, you know, certainly, you know, couldn't give you a specific number as to what, you know, what is driving, you know, him just looking a little bit better on the field over the course of this year. Obviously, he played great defense last year. And actually put up a solid offensive season, but to your point, he's been really good, you know, this year thus far. And I have to imagine for him, just not having to play through pain every day, definitely just eases his mind and allows him to be the best version of himself.
Carter, he seemed to be tapering off last year. Now there's a reverse taper.
Exactly. see, not actually.
Now we can market it.
Now
we got a chance.
Better. Yeah.
How many people experiment with it? I read somewhere that Bellinger was using it last year, and then obviously the Yankees are using it. How many people have been? I mean, do we expect to see more of it, or is it just kind of depend on the person and how comfortable they are with it?
Yeah, I would expect that we'll see more of it. I mean, it's kind of like all of us 20 years ago when, you know, you had that buddy that was like, hey, I got this thing called a Big Bertha, and it's like, it helps me hit it a little bit further. And you're like, ah, I like mine. It feels good. Like, I'm going to hit mine for a while. And then over time, you're like, ah, crap, like this guy's hitting it 20 yards farther than me every time. I think that'll happen over time as guys get used to it and it just becomes more prevalent throughout the league. So that'd be my expectation. My expectations aren't always right, but I imagine it'll go that direction.
Carter, let's talk about Michael Busch for a second, because on one hand, I see a guy who is an ascending player, first base, his defense has gotten really good. He's the cleanup hitter. And I don't know if we look at the way we look at cleanup hitters the way we used to look at cleanup hitters, because if we did that, I don't think that the cleanup hitter 20 years ago, 10 years ago, might have been pinch hit for in the fifth inning because of a matchup on the mound. Michael Busch has been a guy that I think, you know, has run into that a couple times this season already. How valuable is he to this team? Do you understand kind of like maybe sometimes the confusion we see from the outside when the guy is pinch hit for if he's batting cleanup, and you think, how could you do that in that spot? I guess, what is the overall philosophy when that happens, and what, how much do you value his offensive abilities?
Yeah, I mean, kind of a two-part answer here. I think one, focusing on Michael Busch, you know, he is extremely valuable, right? You talked about his defense already. You know, he's had just consistent at-bats. You know, he's been able to drive the baseball. You know, he is, you know, an above-average first baseman for us. And from that perspective, you know, to have him under control for as long as we do, we are thrilled to have him. So I think that's, you know, park Michael Busch for a second. I think the second question you're asking is, okay, like with traditional lineup spots, like in doing untraditional things with those lineup spots, like why would you do something like that? And the short answer is, you know, you feel like that's going to help you win the game more effectively. So if, you know, we feel like Justin Turner is going to hit a left-handed pitcher, or someone else is going to hit a left-handed pitcher, a specific left-handed pitcher, better than a specific left-handed hitter, and we're in a high-leverage situation like that, we're going to make that move. So the decision there is, you know, hey, in this particular situation, this player is better, this other player is better. But in general, you know, we feel like the other guy is really, really, really good. So, yeah, I think it's different, right? And I think I can understand why, you know, someone would say, hey, why would that be happening if that guy's a cleanup hitter? But the short answer is, in this specific example or this specific situation, this is the best way for us to try to win this baseball game, and that's why we do it.
You know, all the talk is, as David mentioned, about Kyle Tucker, King Tuck, what he can do. I've really enjoyed seeing Matthew Boyd. I've really enjoyed Carson Kelly. It feels like some of the guys you added have maybe exceeded my expectations. Probably not
John
yours.
Birdie?
Yeah, John Birdie, fast.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we liked those guys, or else we wouldn't have given them so much money. But, you know, from that perspective, yeah, we're encouraged by their starts. They've fit, you know, seamlessly into the clubhouse, and, you know, to your point, have really, really done well early in the year. And, you know, look, it's extremely early, and we have a long way to go. But the way those guys go about their business, you know, the way they prepare for each game, my expectations is, you know, that we'll be in a really good place with them going forward, and excited that we have them.
It is extremely early, but heading into yesterday's game, I believe the Cubs led the majors in runs scored, stolen bases, and walks. So from your perspective, when you look at this team offensively, what is its strength?
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, right? Like, we're looking to score runs. How are we going to do that better than other teams? Well, probably not going to hit more home runs than other teams or than all of the teams. We'll be up there. We got some guys that can really drive the baseball, but got a lot of fast guys, a lot of smart guys, a lot of intelligent guys that are really going to play every game 100%. You've seen all those plays we've had early where, you know, runner on first and he beats out a force play at second. That extends an inning. That gives us an opportunity to score more runs. You've seen us steal bases. You've seen us take extra bases. I think that aggression, that pressure definitely allows us to create more runs either through getting more outs or just, you know, being able to advance guys. And I think you've seen our ability to really put pressure on the pitcher by making him come into the zone, by taking balls that are, you know, an inch or 2 inches off the plate. You know, you watch some of the teams have been really, really good over the last several years, and their hitters are able to do that. You know, we'll play a Dodgers team this weekend. Their hitters are really good at doing that. They make you come into the zone. And if you can be patient and make pitchers make mistakes, you got an opportunity to capitalize on them. So, yeah, I think it's those things and, you know, encouraged about the early results so far.
I always wonder when I see a guy who hits rather unconventionally, like Matthew Shaw's stance, is that more difficult for a hitting coach to work with a guy? Does that take extra work? Does that take extra kind of, it's just such an odd stance. We've certainly seen other guys with that kind of stance, but I just wonder what, is that a hitting coach's nightmare?
Oh, no nightmare. Probably enjoy it for sure in terms of just, you know, having something else to think about. You know, the thing about hitters is they all get back to similar positions after their load, right? So right. The stance is kind of a comfort position to where they start. I mean, think about Craig Counsell, right? Like where he started. Like his position, if you freeze framed it as the pitch is starting to be released from the pitcher, is going to look very similar to all other hitters. And so the path to get to that, you know, that convergent position for all hitters is a little bit more difficult if you have a little bit more unorthodox stance, but it's still the same thing. So I think for a hitting coach and for that hitter, it's just, okay, how are you going to get from this place of comfort to this next place of success that looks like what all successful hitters do? And yeah, that's a little bit more difficult, but it's offset by the comfort that it gives the hitter.
All right, Carter, so earlier you referenced Big Bertha. We are distracted in the studio here because we're watching the Masters. Is there a Masters pool in the Cubs front office, and do you have a prediction for who's going to win this weekend?
If there's a Masters pool, I was left out of it. I probably had my head in the computer a little bit too much over the last couple of weeks to know what's going on there. But in terms of who is going to win, the chatter down in the clubhouse was that Rory hasn't looked as good as he looked unbelievable relative to how he's typically gone into the Masters. So I'm going to give him that one. And if we win that one, I wish I would have been in the pool.
Great stuff. Carter, thanks a ton. Great catching up. You really appreciate it.
Thanks, Carter.
Yeah, likewise, fellas. Take care.
That's a lot of fun. That's Carter Hawkins.
The Grand Bigs. Bigs time.
Bigs.
With Mully and Haw. Bigs time.
The Bigs Report.
With Brad Biggs.
Bigs time.
Bigs.
His name is Brad Biggs.
Brad Biggs talks football with you.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, the score. Brad Biggs is the football man of the Chicago Tribune, a longtime contributor to the station and a valued friend, and he joins us now on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, aturo.com. Big Zay!
Morning, Brad.
Morning, boys. What's going on?
Well, I really appreciate getting a chance to talk to you, Brad, because a lot of the stuff that you're writing about, you had a question in the mailbag where someone wanted to know if there are scenarios that haven't really been discussed about who the Bears could take with the 10th overall pick. And I found that really interesting because we had a conversation recently where we were talking about just different ideas, kind of outside the box stuff. And we got into the corners a little bit, and you talk about the cornerback situation. And, you know, I don't know how to feel. I don't think they're giving up on Tyrique Stevenson. I don't believe that. But I do think that this is a super important year for a guy that was shaky a bit last year, ran afoul of some trouble, obviously was benched after the incident with the Hail Mary pass in Washington, and then did not take well to that and seemed to really be impacted by it. So, you know, hopefully new staff, new coaches, they can get to him, they can get the best out of him. But Jalen Johnson is going to be apparently running around the field guarding the best receiver. Good idea. And I don't know if we believe that Tyrique Stevenson is going to be the guy that maybe they thought he was when they moved up and drafted him.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation because they've got some depth at the cornerback position. And if they sell the idea that they believe new secondary coach Al Harris can bring the very best out of a young and talented Tyrique Stevenson, you know what? I'd sit back and watch that. Like, I'd be open-minded about him being able to play with more consistency. The question I got in the mailbag was, is there a scenario for that 10th pick that maybe hasn't been publicly discussed or kicked around in right. the media or has gone under the radar a little bit? I would have a high level of confidence that inside the building, the Bears are there are no, like, under-the-radar possibilities, that everything is being evaluated, which is a process that's ongoing. But in my answer to the question, I said, well, you know, one possibility, and I'm not saying it's a likelihood, but here's something we haven't heard a lot about. What about a cornerback at 10? Because at 10, potentially you're taking the second cornerback in the class after Travis Hunter, who's a cornerback and a wide receiver. And if your grade on a cornerback that's available at that point, Will Johnson from Michigan could be a possibility, is considerably higher than what you've got on an edge rusher or a potential offensive lineman that might be able to, you know, play tackle, and you're going to remain true to your grading system, well, maybe you go with a corner there, and then, you know, if you feel like you've got a really top flight corner coming out of the draft, well, I mean, you get that position really locked down then, and you've also got some depth.
So, Brad, the players reported back to Hallis Hall on Monday for the beginning of the offseason program, and we heard from many of them a day later. What, if anything, held any significance to you based on what you heard from some of the Bears?
Well, I mean, I'd listen to Jalen Johnson, folks. You know, he's – I would advise fans and other members of the media probably to listen to Jalen Johnson when, you know, he pointed out that he's, you know, he's been through – the off-season hype, and he knows what that looks like, and that doesn't mean a thing in the regular season. We've talked on the program about the Bears hanging, off-season championship banners inside the Walter Payton Center. Right, they're running out of room in the rafters. You've got to go out and you got to play better during the season. You got to play more consistently, and you've got to win more football games. So. I thought Jalen Johnson kept it real, and there is reason for optimism here. I like the head coaching hire a lot. I'm intrigued by some of the guys on Ben Johnson's staff. moves in free agency and otherwise, trades to fortify the roster have made sense. But they've got to get better through the draft. They've got to get some impact players through the draft. They've got to draft and develop their young players. And they've got to get a better and stronger roster as well.
So we had
I saw some people kind of made a big deal about Tremaine Edmonds saying, you know, they're in win now mode.
Yeah.
Let's just press the pause button here and evaluate this. You've got a player.
Why?
Saying they're in win now mode. Like, if a player says anything other than that, it's newsworthy.
Well, then that's what Jalen Johnson is saying. He's saying, well, I'm not that excited. You shouldn't be that excited. We're just going to disappoint you anyway.
A player saying we're in win now mode? Yeah, of course you're in win
Tremaine
now mode.
Tremaine Edmonds did not say just we're in win now mode. He said that Ben Johnson entered the room, you liked what you heard, he gets it, and he's the guy that we believe in.
Well, of course they believe in him, and they believed in Eberflus until he wasn't the coach anymore.
I want you to tell me the Bears are leading the league in offseason victories. I don't need the leaders of the Bears to tell me to tone things down because it's too much hype. I want them to believe that they're one season away from going to the playoffs, or they're one season away. They're in win now mode. I want to hear that from the players.
Did you buy into the Justin Fields as my quarterback when they were, you know, three quarters of the way through the 2023 season, and it was abundantly clear to anyone without Kool-Aid glasses on that he wasn't going to be the quarterback of the Bears? I mean, did you want to hear that too?
That's a different scenario. That was in season. We had evidence. When you're starting a new regime, I'm okay with over-the-top optimism from players who were in there and believing that they're capable of doing things that they may not have done before.
I'm cool with him saying that, but it's like people look, they're in win-now mode. Well, yeah, of course the player's going to say they're in win-now mode. Let's see what they do in the draft. Let's see what things look like this summer. And we'll hopefully look a heck of a lot better. And they'll hopefully be a heck of a lot more competitive and won't fall into the kind of traps and ruts that destroyed this past season.
I had no problem with the Bears staying with Braxton Jones last year, because he still had a couple of years left on his contract, and you didn't know what you had on your offensive line. They made some moves, and they came out and said the offensive line was going to be better than ever and all that. But the reality is that they've now brought in three new starters on the interior of that line, and they've got a right tackle they drafted and believe in, and the left tackle will not be able to start training camp. He's going to be added as the year goes on. And maybe they're shooting for the season opener with him. I don't know how quickly he will be up and running, but it does worry me both that he is injured right now and that his contract runs out at the end of the year. And I think it makes it more critical than ever to get a left tackle. Now, I want to ask you about who that would be if you believe that Will Campbell would be there at 10, if he's moving or if he's set there. And I want to get your take on Armand Membau, the kid from Mizzou.
The right tackle.
You're familiar with him. Played right tackle in college, but there are people that believe he might be able to play on the left side in the NFL. That seems like a real reach. I talked to a guy last week. Well, I got you, but it's going to be tough if you can't start the season with Braxton Jones.
Yeah, let's not rule Braxton Jones out for the start of training camp yet. Like, let's just
okay.
That's a long ways off. I'd be so open minded. Obviously, he's not going to be, you know, full strength this spring, but with camp a long ways off, we'll see where that is. It's an interesting situation because if Will Campbell's not there, and some teams are evaluating Will Campbell as a guard, what are you going to do with Membau? Listen, there are teams that are looking at him. More teams looking at him as a guard than as a left tackle. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
Because in a lot of times these college programs, when they've got a guy that's played right tackle for them, they're telling you without telling you that the guy's not a left tackle in the
right,
NFL.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
That's why, you know, Tevin Jenkins was a right tackle at Oklahoma State, and he was not cut out to play left tackle in the National Football League. So it's interesting because it's not like there was this super left tackle candidate that was available in free agency that they weren't able to get. Ronnie Stanley re-signed with the Baltimore Ravens. I think they're aware of the issue there. Are there potentially some guys they could get in round two that would fit there? Josh Connerly of Oregon. I don't know how they feel about Josh Simmons out of Ohio State, who's coming off a knee injury.
Kelvin Banks.
You hear some up and down things about him. I don't think it's their plan. I would be curious if they've completely ruled out the idea of using Joe Tooney at left tackle. I don't know.
Yeah.
I highly doubt that's plan A.
Yeah, I hope that's not plan A.
It might be plan B, but is it something that you can't discount? So we'll have to see. But, you know, when you get Drew Dahlman, who in my opinion is the big addition on the offensive line, you get Tooney, you get Jonah Jackson, and you're, you know, given the appearance that you're intent on building it from the inside out, you know, can you really say you fully committed to it when you basically flipped a couple mid to late round picks and made one big signing without using a high draft pick on your offensive line? Like, do you have to do that to kind of follow through on that process?
Good stuff, Brad. Thanks for the insight. Good
Thank
to
you,
talk
buddy.
To you.
Great catching up.
Have a great day, guys.
And now the starting lineup for your Chicago Cubs.
Chicago Cubs baseball is on the air from Wrigley Field in Chicago.
Pitching this afternoon's ball game for the Cubs, number 16, Matthew Boyd.
Veteran left-hander Matthew Boyd going today. This would be his 11th Major League season, first obviously with the Cubs.
A lot of gratitude just to be part of this ball club, part of this franchise, be able to go pitch in Wrigley Field, you know, in front of these amazing fans and part of the history here. It's special, and it's something I don't take lightly.
Swing and a miss. Off-speed pitch got him. Tatis out on strikes. Not one of his better swings. One down.
Yeah, my grandfather would love this. Know what it meant to him. Know what it means to my dad. You know, just to put on this uniform.
Swing and a miss. Strike three. Good high fastball got him.
Getting to do that out there today and hear the fans, you know, get loud, and it's such an intimate setting. It's really special.
Strike three. Gone. Cronenworth out on strikes. Swing and a miss. Strike three. Boyd strikes out Machado.
So many different ways to get people out. I mean, so many different pitches. He's willing to throw anything at any time. And it just made it so impressive that he can execute a plethora of pitches no matter at what point in the game, no matter if there's people on. He's really good with the running game. He's just a true pro. And, you know, we're very glad that he's on our team and he takes the ball every fifth day.
Matthew Boyd with his second straight shutout performance run. Five innings against Arizona last Sunday. Six shutout innings against San Diego today.
That'll get it done.
Spiegel and Holmes, afternoons on the school.
A couple of starts, no runs have been given up by Matthew Boyd as the Cubs are in first place. They'll play on the score tonight at 6:40, pregame at 6:05. With Zach Zabin. And now Matthew Boyd joins us here on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circa app today. Matthew, first of all, thanks so much for joining us here on the show. Secondly, everyone is always looking for more pitching. Guys that eat innings. Guys that go out there and give you quality starts. With all the choices that were available to you, why was the Cubs your choice?
Well, guys, thank you for having me on. Yeah, when you don't often get to choose I mean, a lot of the times, even when it is your chance to get to choose, your options are limited, right? But as you get to play, you know, Major League Baseball and you travel around and, you know, you see environments like Wrigley Field and you hear about players who play in organizations and you play, like, you hear about guys that play like in for the Cubs and you hear about how highly they speak of it. And, you know, for me, there was always a personal connection to the Cubs. I just loved, my grandfather was a diehard Cubs fan and he, was just, I don't think I fully understand the depth of his love for the Cubs. But I started to, as I got older and older, and because of his love for the Cubs, I had a love for the, you know, a small love for the Cubs is kind of like, you know, my second team. And, when they called in free agency, I was so excited. And it was one of those things where it was like, I knew where I wanted to be and I'm really thankful.
Had a chance to talk to you on Friday in the clubhouse, Matthew, and, nice to talk to you about your dad who was there. Your father, Kurt, was there Friday. I've got to assume he was there Saturday when you pitched. What did that feel like to have your grandfather in your mind and on your heart and your dad in the house? And there you are making the first start and it goes that beautifully with six shutout innings. It's unbelievable.
I'm grateful. I'm grateful. You know, it was really special. I mean, the day before opening day, I was walking around the field with my dad. I showed him the clubhouse and we got to walk on the field and, you know, walk around. He got to go touch the bricks and, you know, see the ivy up and close. And you could see the emotion kind of overwhelming. That was overwhelming to him. And, you know, his first words he said, he goes, "Wow, what I would give to switch spots with my dad right now so he could witness this." And and I say that I don't think I understood the gravity of it. Like I don't think I fully will, but you know, my dad does. And to see, I think anyone who knows, just, I mean, you have that love of family and you know those people that you love and you see what something means to them. I mean, playing for the Cubs will always be something that was a dream of mine, but to see it, to do it and then have my dad have the emotions and knowing that he has the emotions for his father. It's just something I'm like, I've got chills kind of saying it. It's just really special. And again, I have a ton of gratitude to just wear this uniform.
It's a very interesting thing that happens to all of us, like as we get older, where maybe we see things that we didn't want to see or couldn't see when we were younger. You seem to have an appreciation for this that we don't ordinarily hear from current players. Like the way you're talking about it is how we usually hear it from guys that have retired and are looking back at it. Where does this come from where you have decided that you're going to live in some of that joy towards the end of your career?
Well, I didn't get a job at the beginning of the year. I was rehabbing Tommy John surgery. You know, I had a surgery before that for my flexor that, you know, we thought was going to fix the problem. And I just never really felt right after that to kind of sum things up quickly, you know? And, so I came off a bad year and then, you know, it wasn't healthy. And then, you know, it was clear I needed Tommy John and then, you know, wasn't able to get a big league deal. So, you know, last off season, I had the perspective of watching from home and it was one of those things where it's like, you never know if you're going to get an opportunity. And now my belief in what I know I could do never wavered. You know, I was like, if I get the chance to have a ball in my hand, I know exactly what I'm going to do and I'm going to prepare like crazy, but I had to try out essentially. And you never know if you're going to get that deal. So, I'm grateful. I believe my best baseball is ahead of me. I believe that, you know, I have more than a couple of years left. I want to play, you know, much longer than that. I'd love to play into my 40s. I don't know if I'm going to be granted that opportunity, but I do have a ton of gratitude for where I am today, knowing that it all can be gone very fast. And to get to wear a baseball uniform, not to mention that Cubby blue with the pinstripes, man, it's something that, you know, I only could dream about as a kid. So, you know, that's kind of what plays into that.
Matthew Boyd came back with Cleveland last year in 8 outings, 39 2/3 innings, had a 2.72 ERA. with 46 Ks, 13 walks, and it looks really, really good to start the season. I, you know, when you talk about what it means and like not fully grasping, and I'm thinking about your grandfather in 2016, it's like we had the chance to be here and be doing shows at, during that whole season, and like, you know, and for the parade. And the story I'll always think about, Matthew, is like many people who said they went to their parents' grave and listened to the games on the score and the Cubs radio network at the grave of their parent or grandparent. You know, it's just unbelievable. So where was your grandfather? What was his 2016 win the World Series moment? Where was he?
Yeah, so he was in Medford, Oregon. That's where, you know, he grew up here in Chicago, and was in the Navy for 30 years. And he, you know, ended up laying roots down in Southern Oregon. And he was watching that game at home, and I was very bitter. We missed the playoffs by just a game in Detroit that year. So I'm at home watching our division rival Guardians, you know, take on the Cubs. And I was at my parents' house with my wife, and we were watching the game with my dad, because obviously he's a Cubs fan too. And I just remember him, my dad, right when they got that final out, he called my grandpa on speakerphone, and my grandpa just, like, you could hear a man that didn't show emotion, you know, and you could hear he wasn't saying anything. He was just, you could hear him trying to get some words out, but like, wow, you know, you could tell how much it meant to him. And you know, it was just cool to feel the joy for him in that moment. So, you know, definitely, you know, now that I'm here, every time I get to walk out on that field, he's on my mind.
Amazing. Is it true that when he would call you after your starts for Detroit, he would end up wanting to talk Cubs with you? Is that true?
Yeah, you know, I could tell the mood he was in if the Cubs won or lost that day, you know, and if I had a bad game, it'd usually be, you know, well, you know what Kyle Hendricks and John Lester do. And I'm like, thanks, Grandpa. You know, I play against them. I appreciate that. You know, so, you know, he was that kind of Chicago fan, you know, he was all about it. And it was like that with the Bears and the Blackhawks too. So, you know, I mean, he was, I didn't really understand it fully. Now that I'm out here and I'm getting to know more and more people out here, it makes more and more sense. And it's like, I'm just grateful I get to be, you know, part of this now. So, it's something special, and I'm very, very thankful for it.
Matthew, I appreciate the fact that you're not allowing this to be a pressure, that you're kind of running towards it. And there are a lot of people, because of Wrigley Field and Cubs fandom and what you experience inside your family, there'd be a lot of players who are like, you know what, I'll just go play for the Rangers instead. But I like that you're running toward this. Just you wait, man. When the weather gets nice and you guys are good, oh boy, is it going to be a lot of fun over there at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, I've seen it from the other dugout, and it's something really, really special, you know. So it's something that it's, you can already feel it now. It felt like it was freezing last night, and I couldn't believe how many people were here and how loud they were getting. So it was, it's, you know, us as players, we're grateful for that energy, and we're grateful to, you know, be part of this, this giant Chicago family, you know.
Cool. Justin Steele was awesome last night. You said that you ended up watching a lot of Shota Imanaga and Justin Steele last year. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So from afar, what did you like about watching those two lefties who do it differently than mm-hmm. you, but you know, yeah. Both lefties at Wrigley now.
Yeah, no. So I've watched Steele since he kind of came in the league, and he's a guy that rides a fastball up in the zone, the lefty that rides a fastball up in the zone. And Shota is a low release guy that kind of does a similar thing too. So obviously Steely was out for some of the early part of the year, but like I was at home, right? I was doing rehab and I was, you know, helping homeschool the kids in the mornings with my wife. And then I'd go get my work done and do my rehab and throwing and workouts, and then come home and coach softball and t-ball for my sons. And during the day, I'd just be watching different guys, usually as many lefties as I could, just trying to stay and keep my mind there, you know? And so Shota and Steely, you know, were guys that I just really enjoy watching. And it was really fun to watch what Shota did last year. and with, you know, dominate with, you know, his stuff and his uniqueness. And for me, you know, we have similarities, but we also have, you know, we're also very unique in our own way. So if there's always something to glean from that, and, you know, getting to be in a rotation with lefties like those guys, it's something that every day, whether you watch them attack a game or attack their bullpen work in between their starts, there's always something to learn. And I know it makes me a better pitcher.
There's some commonalities.
I'm 34 years old, but mm-hmm. I'm always learning.
Some commonalities maybe with Shota, like he's a fly ball guy. People were afraid that he was going to give up a lot of homers in MLB, but he hasn't. And you've got mm-hmm. some fly ball tendencies, but you know, maybe Wrigley's not the worst place for that in some ways. We used to think of it that way.
No, you know, and I think fly balls aren't bad as long as you're limiting the hard contact, right? It's, you know, the game is the play. You know, you got to change speeds. You got to play east, west, north, south, and front to back. And as a pitcher, and if I can just, you know, and this is what Shota does really well. If you can make their get a hitter off of their A swing and make them slow down their barrel a little bit, whether that's a ground ball or a pop up or a weak fly ball, you've done your job as a pitcher. And I think, you know, it speaks to what Shota has done and you know, a reason why he's had so much success right now, like in you know, in the big leagues, is his ability to do that, right? And it's really fun to watch.
Matthew, thank you so much for your time, man. We know that you got pregame stuff to do, and we appreciate you jumping on the phone with us. This was absolutely delightful, and we wish you continued health and continued success.
Hey, thank you guys for having me on. Look forward to doing it again.
Thanks, Matthew. It's Matthew Boyd.
Your new favorite Cub.
Yeah, man. I knew we needed to talk to that guy.
Jeez. Like, look, Speaks, how many interviews do we do with guys where just by the nature of what it is that they do, they're over it. Like, they're over all the stuff that we romanticize about.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is leaning into it.
Big time. And because he was feeling it last year, he didn't think he was going to get a shot again. He's what did he say? He was coaching softball. He was, you know, doing errands around the house and then watching baseball and hoping he gets another shot. And he got another shot. And I love him thinking that his best baseball is in front of him. At 34, that has always been a legit arm with legit stuff. Was talking to Eno Saris yesterday, or on Sunday, from The Athletic, and he brought up Boyd unsolicited. He's like, ooh, they might have found something with Boyd, and he brought up the fly ball thing that I mentioned to him, but said that Boyd is one of those guys who goes slow, slower, slowest. He throws like slider, changeup, curve, and then, oh, there's a fastball at 94, which feels like 99. So he knows what he's doing as a pitcher. If you're somebody who loves pitchers who really think about it, you'll dig him. And then if you're somebody who loves the ballpark and loves the familial connection and the generational connection, how do you not love that guy?
And that's just over 900 innings on a starter's arm in 10 years.
Yeah.
That's fresh.
Yeah, there's theoretically a lot of miles left there. Just had Tommy John, and we all know it could happen again. It can blow up at any time.
He could also change what type of pitcher he is. You know what I mean?
Could've like learn something in the rehab.
Or how he's used going forward if he wants to keep pitching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it being more of a specialist. He could do that, you know, if he wants to continue pitching into his 40s. I love hearing that. You know,
he's comfortable in his skin and leaning into it, to your point, man.
It's fun.
I love the image of Grandpa calling up after, like, Grandpa, I just went 6 1/3 against the Guardians. I had a pretty good day.
Have you pitched against Chris Bryant?
Yeah. Did you see what my Cubs did? Yeah, whatever, Grandpa. Cram it. All right? I'm not so interested. Amazing.
They're building they built a group of guys that make it very easy to root for them.
Yeah, I got to tell you, like, there was a moment talking to him, because I knew about his dad and his grandpa, so we talked about that. And then I can't remember if I said this to you yesterday. I don't think so. I think I might have said it on Sunday. I was talking to him about my dad, because like when I brought my dad to the World Series in 2016 at Wrigley, and it was his first ever World Series game, and he was 83 at the time, and I had to hold his arm to make sure that he was stable as we walked in. And we got to the seats, and he was looking around like a kid at a candy store. And I realized that he had walked me in that way. Like, I broke down. So, like, here, I was talking with Matthew Boyd about that, because he was just standing there. And he said to me at the end, he said, thanks for sharing that with me, man. Thanks for sharing that with me. Like, we had a genuine moment, and I could tell, like, all right, this dude was actually listening. I like listening to him. Let's talk to that man on the radio. I mean, that's...
And he said he'll come back on the show.
He volunteered it.
Which is, you know...
Looking forward to doing it again.
That's a big deal for us.
Yeah, there's a lot of pitching we could talk. That guy's been around. He knows stuff. Different organizations, different ways to do it. How about him dissecting Shota and Steele? That's just scratching the surface.
I really like that, too, because sometimes in comps, you tend towards people that are a little bit more like you instead of being like, well, wait, maybe I should get more like them.
It's just watching more lefties.
And being able to look at two guys who do it differently, like he was saying, and then adding it to what makes you unique, I think is a very cool way to go about things.
Yeah, that's a really useful starting pitcher. If he can stay healthy, that's a guy who can be very, very good in this ballpark.
Let's not have anything happen to Matthew Boyd.
We must protect Matthew Boyd.
At all costs.
Yeah, we must.
At all costs. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, look, Jalen Johnson's our guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are people who are probably a little surprised, Dustino, that he was at OTAs today. But he was there for a lot of reasons. And he also was behind the microphone talking about some things. Talking about some things that you had to live through last year. And he did as well. We'll let you hear from our guy, Jalen Johnson, next here on The Score.